Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Michael Goldfarb, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Despite President Bush's claims that terrorists are on the run, the recent attacks in Saudi Arabia and Spain show the Al-Qaeda network remains a serious threat. And despite being cornered at the end of the Afghan war, Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden is still a free man. How did bin Laden manage to slip unnoticed out of Afghanistan? Tonight, On Point, Al-Qaeda's great escape and who should be held responsible. But first, we turn to Washington, where President Bush and Vice President Cheney today testified in front of the 9/11 Commission. Their joint three-plus-hour appearance before the panel was the result of a prolonged negotiation between the White House and the Commission. Here's what President Bush had to say about the meeting after it ended.
We answered all their questions, and as I say, I think I came away good about the session because I wanted them to know, you know, how I set strategy, how we run the White House, how we deal with threats.
Michael Isikoff has been covering the 9/11 Commission hearings for Newsweek, where he's an investigative correspondent. Earlier today, I asked him to describe the circumstances of President Bush and Vice President Cheney's testimony.
All the commissioners were there, all 10 commissioners, and senior staff director for the commission, White House lawyer Al Gonzalez, and a White House note taker. But the remarkable thing is that not only was it not under oath, but there's no transcript that's going to be made. There's no tape recording of the event, no videotape of the event. So all that will be memorialized here is beyond the recollections of the commissioners and whatever notes they personally took as the note takers from the commission and from the White House.
Michael, you've been covering Washington for decades. Has there ever been a similar situation?
It's hard to remember something quite analogous to this. One thinks, for example, of President Clinton when he testified before Ken Starr's team from the Independent Counsel's office. There was, of course, a videotape made of that. But then again, that was in lieu of a grand jury appearance, so the precise language had to be communicated to the grand jurors in that case. But a private meeting like this, you'd be hard-pressed to find something quite analogous to it. Obviously, once a videotape or an audio tape or a precise transcript is made, it becomes something in and of itself for which there becomes a public clamoring for its release. So the public wants to see it, the media wants to see it, and inevitably these things tend to get out.
But Mike, how will we know when the panel issues its final report? How will we know what information they had from the president and the vice president?
Well, other than in their report, to the extent that they attribute comments to the president or vice president, I doubt there'll be exact quotes because since there's no record, getting exact quotes becomes a bit hazardous. But they may paraphrase comments that the president or the vice president made, but we'll just have to read the report. If you read the report, and I'm talking about the interim staff reports that have come out, there's a lot of fascinating details in there that reflect the thousands of interviews they've conducted by now, but there's very rarely exact quotes. So I think that probably the sections of the staff report will read a lot like these interim reports.
Why did the panel accept these conditions laid down by the White House?
Well, look, there had been this extensive wrangling that had been going on for months between the commission and the White House over access to documents, over access to individuals, over getting stuff declassified, and it had become a very protracted and at times quite acrimonious series of negotiations. The president had insisted at the outset that he would only talk informally for 1 hour to the chairman and the vice chairman, Tom Kane and Lee Hamilton. That was unacceptable to the rest of the commissioners, who made the point, hey, we're co-equal members of this panel. We all have to sign our names to this report, and we all want to hear and see what the president has to say. The more they pushed, and this came in the context of also the many debates about release and access to president's daily briefs and other sensitive intelligence documents, in the course of the negotiations, when the White House finally threw in the towel and allowed, for example, Condoleezza Rice to testify in public under oath before the commission, they retreated a bit by allowing the president to meet before all 10 commissioners, but insisted as one more condition that it be done with the vice president and it be done under these conditions where there's no record or transcript made.
So this was all part of the quid pro quo to allow Condi Rice to testify in public under oath. It was just one enormous negotiation about the inner circle and how they would be called to account before the commission.
Right. I mean, you have to remember, just taking the long sweep of this, the White House never wanted this commission in the first place. They always thought it would be a distraction. They always thought it would be potentially politically embarrassing to them. They fought not only to have the commission not be created originally, but then when it was, to have as limited the disclosure of internal documents as possible. They've come a pretty long way, but I guess for face-saving purposes, they needed a few fig leaves to hold on to here. And
Well, no official transcript strikes me as being more than a fig leaf. It's like chainmail and armor to protect you. But one last question. How long do you think it's going to take before we start getting leaks and getting a sense of what was actually said?
Well, you already have some of the commissioners who have begun to talk a little bit, not saying a whole lot. But also, remembering the political context of this, it's very clear that the commission is trying to tone down any semblance of partisanship at this point. This kind of reached the acrimonious testimony and aggressive prosecutorial questions reached its peak that week right after Richard Clark testified, followed the next week by Condoleezza Rice, in which there was some very aggressive questioning of Rice. Since then, there's been a bit of a political backlash. Both Tom Kane, the chairman, and Lee Hamilton, the vice chairman, have become concerned that the commission itself was going to be viewed in a political context and this would devalue the report. So they have admonished the rest of the commissioners to tone down the aggressive questioning. You saw that reflected in the last round of hearings when John Ashcroft and Louis Freeh testified. And my strong hunch here is that there was not very aggressive questioning of the president or vice president, and that there's not going to be any smoking guns or sharp, dramatic moments that took place, so there'll be very little to leak out.
Mike Isikoff, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael Isikoff is an investigative correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He spoke with me from Washington, D.C. In December 2001, the American military stood poised at Tora Bora in Afghanistan to bring in Osama bin Laden, dead or alive. The media was there, too, waiting with bated breath for the big scoop. Back on the home front, Americans were watching for news that the man responsible for the 9/11 attacks was captured. But bin Laden had already managed to slip out of Afghanistan into Pakistan, unnoticed, as veteran war correspondent Philip Smucker had reported earlier that month. In a new book, Al-Qaeda's Great Escape, The Military and the Media on Terror's Trail, Smucker recounts his own hunt for Osama and takes a hard look at how inaccurate intelligence and America's post-9/11 rage led to a flawed battle plan that left the U.S. military empty-handed in its efforts to bring in bin Laden. This hour on Point, Al-Qaeda's Great Escape, and who should be held responsible. On Point, listeners, can the war on terror be won without bringing in Osama bin Laden? Do you have confidence that he will ever be captured? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now online from Washington is Philip Smucker, veteran war correspondent and author of the new book, Al-Qaeda's Great Escape, The Military and the Media on Terror's Trail. Hello, Philip.
Hello, sir. Nice to be here.
So let's jump right in. What were the major failures in U.S. planning that led to the escape of Osama bin Laden?
Well, thanks for framing the dilemma there at the outset, what we faced 3 months after 9/11 at Tora Bora. And if we could take a step back and remember also that this is the only time that this administration had what is known in spy parlance as actionable intelligence. when we had Bin Laden in the crosshairs. We knew his map coordinates. Dick Cheney had popped up, in fact, the very end of November to say that we think he's gone to ground at Tora Bora. He's got caves. He feels safe there. And this is Dick Cheney, of course, popping up from his own underground digs to tell us this. There was an offensive mounted, but it was mounted with a strategy that was based in part upon the old idea dreamt up in the Clinton administration by George Tenet of using Afghan proxies to go after al-Qaeda for us. And in the end, there were only a couple dozen Green Beret fighters, and they were trying to make sense of the loyalties of these proxies, these Afghan warlords, and they were taking money from both sides, taking money from al-Qaeda, and the escape routes in the back were not ever blocked. And Bin Laden and his main cohorts slipped right out the back door.
Okay. Well, let's hold on for a second. You made an interesting point there. There was a plan sort of dreamed up in the Clinton administration by George Tenet using Afghan proxies in coordination with special forces, with Green Berets. Now, there was no obligation on the part of the Bush administration strategists, the defense, you know, the Pentagon strategists at that point, to use those plans. You were in Afghanistan. You were covering the war. We all remember that, you know, it started out and we wondered why it was taking so long to get rid of the Taliban, and then suddenly the whole house of cards collapsed. Why was there a rush at that point to get Osama if they knew where he was?
Well, it was whenever you knew where he was, that was the whole. The 9/11 Commission, by the way, doesn't have purview on this issue, what happened at Tora Bora, but they are reading the book, both former Governor Kaine and Lee Hamilton. But if you look at really what went down there, we had finally knowledge of where Bin Laden had been, Jalalabad, and when he moved into this old ancient redoubt, Tora Bora, which he had refortified. The American public was certainly behind the president when he said we're going to get this guy dead or alive. The fact that we didn't put down light infantry to block the mountain passes was a letdown. In fact, the Washington Post came out with a story 3 months later, a couple of weeks after we did a retrospective in the Monitor, saying that this was the biggest mistake of the Afghan campaign, not putting down those light infantry to block the mountain passes.
Well, one of the very interesting people that you introduce in your book is Colonel Mulholland, who was in charge of the Green Beret units there. Did he not suggest at any time to Central Command that perhaps just a couple of dozen Green Berets here and there trying to direct a bunch of guys who didn't speak their language might not be the most effective way to get into those caves and get a hold of this enemy?
Well, that's an interesting question. I did go over this with him. I had the sense in the 2 hours that I spent with him, and he's quoted extensively in the book, that he was overwhelmed with a lot of things that were going on at that time. And now, if you recall, the idea was to tip the balance by using these northern rebels, the Northern Alliance. And once they had taken Kabul, the game was on. Then we moved into another phase, which was basically a manhunt to capture or kill the top senior leadership of al-Qaeda. And we didn't really turn the corner fast enough. And I don't think Mulholland was ready for that. He told me that there were lessons learned from Tora Bora. He was able to use a different strategy in different battles after that. In fact, at the Battle of Anaconda, the U.S. military, which has the best airlift capability of any military in the world, was able to airlift thousands of fighters to block mountain passes and to fight the enemy eye to eye at the Battle of Anaconda, which was a few months later. So there were strategy shifts taking place. We weren't prepared for this. I argue in my book that really, because Richard Clark also brushes across this issue in his book, 5 pages at the end, he says that, well, we should have gone in there hard, you know, conventional forces. We should have done it quickly with the full force of the U.S. military. And I argue, yes, exactly, we should have done that, but we should have had a plan. And Tommy Franks, if you read Woodward's first book, Tommy Franks was telling him Bush at the table that, sir, I'd like to have a plan for you, but I don't have it, and I'm still working on it. The problem is we didn't coordinate the conventional forces with the elite Green Berets, and we didn't use the tools of our military to the best of our abilities.
On Point listeners, we're talking with Philip Smucker, veteran war correspondent and author of the new book, Al-Qaeda's Great Escape. Philip Smucker was actually at Tora Bora during the fighting and was the first reporter to break the story that Osama bin Laden had actually left Afghanistan. Is it possible to bring in Osama bin Laden so long as he remains in the northwest frontier area, if that's indeed where he is? Can the war on terror be a success until he is brought in? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK is the number to call. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. We're talking this hour, listeners, with Philip Smucker, veteran war correspondent and author of the new book, Al-Qaeda's Great Escape. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK is the number to join in the conversation. Philip was in Afghanistan throughout that war and was at Tora Bora. And Philip, you were the first reporter to break the story that bin Laden had skipped out of Afghanistan, was now in Pakistan. Now, when you broke that story, the U.S. military was still claiming, no, no, he's still in Afghanistan, we know where he is. How did you figure out that bin Laden had fled over the border?
Well, it was due actually to some intrepid reporting by a close colleague who was also working with me, Lutfullah Mashal, who then became the interpreter for the American ambassador in Kabul. But he was penetrating al-Qaeda camps for me for 2 or 3 months prior to Tora Bora, and he was able, we visited a village, and we were told to come back the next day, and we'd be able to interview some senior al-Qaeda characters who were on their way out. It was a safe house. They were passing through the safe house on their way escaping Tora Bora, and we were told to come back the next day. The next day, he came back because I wanted to remain in the hotel. I knew that there would be a potential kidnapping situation. So he did it himself, and he was blindfolded, and actually he was beaten when he tried to leave. But he eventually got to interview one of these chaps who was a senior financier, a Saudi, who had ridden into Tora Bora from Jalalabad, the urban center of Jalalabad, into Tora Bora on the about the 13th of November. The exact dates are all in my text, and so we won't go into the minute here. But he said that this didn't happen, by the way, until in the middle of the heat of the battle of Tora Bora. It's because that battle actually began on December 4th and 5th, and I believe the day we broke our story was the 12th, or the evening of the 12th, day of the 13th. And he said that he described in great detail that bin Laden made a decision 10 days earlier to skip over the border into Pakistan, and he described the exodus of the several senior leaders.
What route did he take? What I'm curious about is the cave network that bin Laden had built in Tora Bora was massive. Did those caves go through mountains and come out in Pakistan, or did he take mountain roads up and over?
No. Actually, there weren't any underground tunnels that led out through entire mountains. There was a great mythology that grew up during the battle. Of course, we thought that there was an elaborate underground. There was something out of James Bond. The planning center, the nexus of the Al Qaeda management. But when we actually were able to comb through the caves in the aftermath, they weren't that extensive. In fact, most of them were just bunkers. He went out on foot over the mountains into Parachinar, Pakistan. It's a little part of Pakistan that juts into Afghanistan, which he could then double back. But he, by all accounts, and these are also captured al-Qaeda prisoners in the aftermath who described the same exodus into Parachinar. He left from Tora Bora on foot, and he went into Parachinar. He had previously been on a horse.
How big a retinue did he have with him? How many people?
In this final fleeting moment there, he was on foot in with a very small group, and it was far smaller than the usual 60 guards that he would travel with. So, as you recall, the Americans had infrared, and it was cold weather. So the sensing ability of the U.S. military was, in fact, getting better as the weather got colder. So I think he was aware of all the technology that the Americans had. And beyond that, then he made a phone call in back into Tora Bora. He was able to communicate with the members who stayed there to fight, and he gave them encouragement and said that his son was coming in to replace him. His son, Syed Adin, came in from Gardez, the Gardez region, which was further to the south east, and he traveled also overland into Tora Bora.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. John is calling from Natick, Mass.
Yeah, I have a question for Mr. Smucker.
Go ahead.
Hello?
John. We're here. We're listening.
What I'd like to know is how much of the decision to send in proxies was political, because this seems to be with almost all administrations, and that is that they're incredibly sensitive to getting American soldiers killed. And if they'd have had to send soldiers into, I don't know where, these dozens or hundreds of caves, I would suspect there would have been a very, very high death rate.
Philip, what's your take on that?
Well, first I'd just say Iraq. Look at what's going on in Iraq today. The will of the American public, I think, was behind the president when he said dead or alive. And by all accounts, the officers, senior officers and ground soldiers that I spoke to, they wanted at these guys. The American military had been trained, and they were capable of doing cave searches, and they didn't need to leave it to other people who we couldn't trust, and frankly, had already been paid off by al-Qaeda. So, yes, it was. I believe it was, in a way, political. It was timid, and the great irony here is, you know, that Bush had come into office saying that he's not going to just shoot cruise missiles into Afghanistan. He's going to have boots on the ground. This was Rumsfeld's idea, that they're going to have boots on the ground, but when it push came to shove, and they had map coordinates, they had Bin Laden in the crosshairs, Cheney had even said, we know where he is, they didn't use the all the tools of the U.S. military, and
Philip,
and
do you think
backfired on them miserably, because we're still paying for it. 31 months after the attacks on American soil, this guy is out there, he's a great escape artist, and he's seen as a great escape artist by his supporters.
John, I want to thank you for your call. You raised an interesting point. Philip, you were just saying, Cheney said, we have him in our crosshairs. Did they really have him in his their crosshairs?
Well, the Tora Bora Redoubt was actually not very big. It was the size and then the area that they were fighting in was slightly exaggerated. There were two valleys within a mountain range, but it was within a few square miles where the al-Qaeda had dug in, and they were ready to fight. In fact, a lot of the fighters who were going to leave decided to stay on when they heard some Americans were coming in. But then the bombing intensified more and more, and then the Afghans came running up the mountain, one side of the mountain, and they didn't see a point. If they weren't going to be able to kill Americans, then these al-Qaeda fighters said, hey, you know, we're gonna get out and save ourselves. Ayman al-Zawahiri, who, you know, is often thought of as the brains of the al-Qaeda organization, wrote in his own memoirs that came out 2 months afterwards that were published in the Arab Press in London that it's better for the senior leadership of al-Qaeda when push comes to shove and when it's about to be executed, when everybody's going to die, to actually flee and fight another day. This was an interesting point that Zawahiri made, because it kind of contradicted the idea of we always need to be a martyr. In fact, what he was saying is that the senior leadership, the brains of the organization, is very important, and, you know, if it's about to be eliminated, they have every right and need to escape and continue the struggle.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Jim is calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Hi, how are you doing?
Okay, Jim.
I have a couple questions for Phil, essentially. My first question kind of, it's been Richard Clark's summation, and it's been fairly evident in the news, that his summation was that early on, extremely early on, shortly after September 11th, there was a powerful connection or a powerful attempt to be made for a connection between Iraq and the events of September 11th. I was wondering if you believe, or at least you felt that in part, that perhaps a more intense effort was not made because of a general idea by that put down through the White House and eventually down through the chain of command through the Pentagon and through the senior commanders that more effort had to be focused less effort had to be focused in Afghanistan, and eventually we had to begin preparing, if you will, for an eventual invasion of Iraq.
That's a good question, Philip.
Well, in fact, I think you're mainly referring to Woodward's new book, which, of course, a lot of us have read, which does point out that even in November, and this is right before the Battle of Tora Bora, that there were decisions made to move ahead with the planning for Iraq. And then it intensified almost immediately when bin Laden stepped across the border into Pakistan. I think it's interesting to look. I mean, some people can see, like to look at history as a series of mishaps, things that went wrong and changed history. Well, what if we had surrounded the mountain passes? What if we had a plan coordinating the conventional forces with the Green Berets and we had rounded up bin Laden? Would the planning for Iraq have gone ahead so hastily at such a pace? One wonders. I mean, I understood that there are a lot of hawks in this administration, but with that feather in their cap, having rounded up bin Laden, you know, and made good on their commitment, you know, saying they're going to get this guy dead or alive, would it have slowed the progress towards a movement and invasion into Iraq?
So is your thought, Jim, what do you suspect? Do you think
personally?
That? Yeah, I mean, are you in the service now?
Yes, I am. I'm on active duty in the military, and what I can tell you is based on my own experience. You know, I spent a large part of that particular summer where a lot of the threats, a lot of the innuendo was made about a very serious threat by Osama bin Laden. And then eventually I returned to the United States from that deployment around September of 2001, right in the same time frame.
Are you allowed to tell us where you were deployed?
Yeah, I was actually deployed at the time of September 11th, and I was deployed to that particular part of the world. And when I returned, shortly after, within approximately, I don't know, I'd say 5 or 6 months of a return from my deployment, a new operational mindset, if you will, an operational framework, if you will, came down in that direction of preparing for an eventual, operations or potential operations in Iraq. Now, granted, of course, the military plans for every possible contingency. That's the nature of the military, and that's the nature of the combat arms by design of training. However, I can say with a high degree that I remember very clearly that we began to develop a mindset, if you will, that we had to begin looking at Iraq as an eventuality, not necessarily as a possibility, but more so an eventuality.
And so you're
and I raised a lot of questions, obviously, when it really. So I wasn't surprised by the comments of Clark, and certainly by Woodward's book.
So your suspicion is that perhaps the military was content to stay with the light Green Beret units working with Afghans in the pay of the U.S., rather than looking to put a large-scale ground force in, precisely because they wanted to keep that option reserved for going to war in Iraq fairly quickly.
And that's essentially it. I don't think that any major regional command, central command, southern command, whoever it may be, can carry on to, and this is something I'm sure the chiefs pointed out to the president, you know, that no major command would probably find it difficult to carry out two major operations of that nature and of that magnitude at the same time. And both falling under central command, you know, it seems like the priorities to me, you know, the wind was blowing in the directions of Iraq, and that's the way we sort of drifted.
Jim, I want to thank you for your call. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Mordecai is on the line from Madison, Wisconsin.
Well, Smucker sounds like a spy for the U.S. Armed Forces to me. He crosses the line between journalism and...
Now, Mordecai, why do you say that?
Well, he's using the noun we, pronoun we, him and his Pentagon boys. He's out trying to track the whereabouts of a person who the Arab people regard as a as a heroic figure, he's trying to track him down so he can turn the publish the information. He would be viewed as an enemy combatant, and
Mordecai, you know, you actually raise a very interesting point that I think all of us who cover war have to deal with, which is particularly in this part of the world where we are often the first people to walk in streets, first Westerners to walk in streets in decades. And Philip, you address this in the book. It is a problem as a journalist, isn't it? Sometimes when you're writing and you realize among the people who are reading your stuff may well be, you know, military planners who don't actually have agents or any form of intelligence coming from where you are.
Right. Yeah, I mean, well, I'd like to confirm on the air that I'm actually not a spy.
I can assure our listeners that that's the case.
Right. Right. Well, one of the things that I found really was in the spirit of that moment, a few months after 9/11, the Fourth Estate kind of dropped some of its critical thinking and didn't really give a proper critique to the Battle of Tora Bora, what went wrong in Afghanistan. It was kind of written off as, well, okay, here's a victory, regime change, on to the next battle. And I think that's part of the problem, that we were kind of led by the nose into the next war without enough critical analysis of what was the connection between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. But to go back to Afghanistan, it was considered unusual or strange to question the decision-making of the civilian authorities, actually. And let's remember that we're one of the proudest civilian military divided, the military in America is run by civilians. The key decisions are made. The buck stops in the White House. And those decisions were crucial in those first few months after 9/11. And I think that in some respects, the Fourth Estate dropped the ball and they weren't really examining the decision making that was coming out of the White House.
In the book, I mean, part of the book, it's subtitled, you do refer to the media. What's your assessment of the way the media has been covering, particularly al-Qaeda? It seems to me that when you deal with security sources, intelligence sources, you have to take an awful lot on faith. Do you think that the media generally does a good job of being skeptical about what they're told off the record?
Not nearly enough, no. In fact, look at the guys in the CIA who were willing to talk. There's a guy who's written a book from my publishing house. It's called Through Our Enemy's Eyes. And he writes under the name Anonymous, okay. But he was a senior CIA operative in the Bin Laden unit. And, he was talking to the press. And you know, he had to use his name Anonymous. But the point is that there were people in the CIA who understood the dynamic. And even, you know, in the aftermath and going into this war, there were a lot of people who were saying, this is gonna bring the jihadis, every stripe and color, into Iraq, and it's going to become a proving ground and a great training ground for future al-Qaeda recruits.
Philip?
I think it already has. And we weren't listening to the right voices. These would have been pessimistic voices.
Philip, we're coming to the end of the segment, and I just want to quickly ask you, take a one-word answer, where do you think Osama is today?
I think he's squirreled away in an underground cavern, but he has a coterie of guards, and he has a publicity operation. Okay. And that's the
Philip,
most important
Philip,
thing.
Philip, where? What country?
He is probably not...
Okay, I'm sorry, I'm running out of time. After the break, details on alleged... From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Michael Goldfarb, filling in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Shocking new details came to light this week in the investigation of the alleged sexual and physical abuse of Iraqi prisoners of war by U.S. soldiers and private contractors at the infamous Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. In March, the Army removed 17 soldiers from duty, including a brigadier general who ran the prison. Wednesday night, 60 Minutes 2 revealed that disturbing photographs of U.S. soldiers torturing Iraqi prisoners had surfaced in the investigation. Accusations of rape, beatings, including assault, cruelty, indecent acts, and maltreatment of detainees are being rigorously investigated by the Army, which promises to punish the soldiers involved. We'll hear from the executive producer of 60 Minutes 2 shortly, but first, Robert Baer is a former CIA Middle East bureau chief. He has had access to information gathered by both the Army and CBS. I asked him how he became involved in the case.
I was involved. CBS called me up and wanted to know if it was conceivable that the CIA was involved in interrogating people at Abu Ghraib and torturing them. Apparently, there were two contractors that came to the prison and identified themselves to the MPs as CIA employees.
Okay, let's just stop right there. Contractors. Now, Abu Ghraib is being run as a U.S. military facility. It's the Army that's staffing it. Now, when you say contractors, you mean civilian contractors.
These are civilian contractors hired by defense corporations, were contracted to the Department of Defense. They're civilians. They're not military employees. They're not U.S. government employees. They follow none of the same regulations that any federal government employee would.
And so they came to the prison and were giving orders?
Apparently, they'd come to the prison and they told the MPs that they had been tasked with interrogating the prisoners and that the MPs, before they arrived, were to soften up the prisoners. And they left that undetermined precisely what they were to do.
And then what happened?
Well, I mean, you've got some young kids in that prison, and they obviously didn't know what they were doing. Then they proceeded to beat them. In one case, there's a picture I've seen of an Iraqi who was dead. Apparently, and I repeat this secondhand, he was moved out on a gurney after he died. He'd been put on ice. They wanted to appear as if he were going to a hospital. I don't know what happened to his body. You had other cases that have not been shown in CBS where they were, I don't even want to describe it on the radio, but it's disgusting. They were hanging prisoners from a ceiling and putting bags over their heads and tying what they described as electrodes to their genitals and threatened to shock them. They had simulated sex scenes. I understand also that for a long time they were feeding them by putting their meals or the pots of food in the recreation room, then blowing a whistle, and whoever got to the food got to eat, and who didn't. And then, of course, fights broke out. Several times they turned dogs on them.
Robert, this is astonishing stuff. Now, I had a friend in Iraq who spent time in Abu Ghraib under Saddam, and when he told me about what it was like to be in Abu Ghraib prison, which was it's like the Lubyanka in Iraq. You know, these were stories that he told about what Saddam did to prisoners.
It's much worse than Lubyanka. But see, that's the whole point, is the symbolism. That's where Saddam tortured people. That's where people went and disappeared forever. I visited that prison after the liberation of Baghdad, and it was probably on the 12th or the 13th, and it was awful. The scenes there of bodies torn apart, being eaten by wild dogs, the torture chambers, the execution chambers, the facilities, they put people in rooms that were 5 by 5, maybe 15 people, 20 people, so they could stand up, and they just let them die overnight. So the important thing for us to realize is that when our soldiers are involved in this, we have become Saddam, in effect. I agree with the military. This is not the way the military is fighting this war. It is an exception, but this is precisely the thing that we need to guard against.
It is something that we need to guard against, but I just happened to be in Iraq at the daily press conference the day last month, in March, when it came up, when the U.S. announced that 17 soldiers and their brigadier general had been removed from duty. Now, at the press conference, we asked for more details, and General Kimmett was far from forthcoming. How did the details about why they had been removed from duty at Abu Ghraib come out?
The families brought him out, because
the families of
the actual guards, the MPs, a couple of the MPs have gone to a lawyer, Gary Myers, I understand, and said, we don't want to take the blame for this. There are officers in the line of command who knew about this or should have known about it, and the blame should be widespread, not just our sons or daughters. So they feel that they are going to take the sole blame for what happened at Abu Ghraib. And that's why they went to CBS and other news outlets and want this story to get out the full story. Now, the military, obviously, their argument is this is the worst time to bring it out. CBS was very reluctant to run this story. In fact, they held it off for 2 or 3 weeks at the pleading of the Defense Department.
The thing is that at this moment in Iraq, one can't think of any time between now and the handover of sovereignty when it would be good to bring it out.
There's never any good time, but we've got to remember, this is the United States. We don't do things like this. And the whole point of going into Iraq, because we had the moral high ground, in a sense, whether you're for the war or against it. But, you know, bringing ourselves down to Saddam's level. And another thing we have to keep in mind is that these soldiers, when they got involved in this, are harming our fighting soldiers in Fallujah and Najaf and everywhere else, because when these guys get out of jail, they're going to tell this story, and Iraq is a tribal culture, and they will seek revenge against Americans.
When you have private military contractors turning up at a military prison run by U.S. servicemen, essentially giving them orders as to how to treat prisoners, have you ever heard of anything like this before?
No, I've never heard of it. When I was in the CIA, there was strict rules not to use private contractors on any sort of substantive operation or let them operate on their own. They were always to be under the supervision of a CIA employee who was responsible to the chain of command into U.S. law. Are these people under U.S. law? When the story came out and when it was coming out, I called an agent at the FBI, a friend of mine, and I said, who's in charge of these contractors? And the guy works out in Iraq. He says, I don't know. I mean, the FBI itself doesn't know under whose law they fall. Does it fall under the coalition authority, Iraqi law, or U.S. law? It's outrageous. I mean, that contractors should be allowed to get in this position.
Robert, you know, this is the second thing in which contractors actually have really influenced American policy, military policy, in a bad way. The second case I'm thinking of is the four guys who were killed in Fallujah. It's not their fault. It's slightly different. The U.S., in other words, we have these private military contractors there who are outside the direct chain of command, yet they are clearly part of the U.S. military, so that if four of them are murdered and then mutilated in Fallujah, the U.S. military takes it as an attack on the U.S. military and therefore surrounds Fallujah. And we have almost a month in which the city has been besieged. And the knock-on effect throughout Iraq with Iraqis has been to make them turn against the U.S.
You're exactly right. I mean, the military would not allow four soldiers to go into Fallujah. There's a chain of command. You need orders. You need movement orders. You need permission to do these things. It would have never happened. The place was too dangerous. I don't know what the four contractors were doing there. I mean, it's obviously a tragedy, but when you have these paramilitary organizations, you always get yourself into trouble. I've seen that in the CIA. It always leads to trouble.
We know that 17 soldiers have been relieved of command. They will face court-martial. In looking into this story, have you found whether these private military contractors are going to face any kind of sanction or censure?
Not so far. I haven't heard that. I don't think the military can do anything to them. I think the only thing that could happen is the contracting agency can fire them or stop the contract, but I don't think they're liable under U.S. law, but you'd have to ask a lawyer. You know, this is the tip of the iceberg. We just don't know how far it goes. There's no chain of command, as I said, no reporting facility in all this.
Robert Baer, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Robert Baer was a CIA case officer in the Directorate of Operations from 1976 to 1997, where he served in Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq and Lebanon. He is the author of See No Evil, The True Story of a Ground Soldier in the CIA's War on Terrorism. While the Army has forcefully condemned all the behavior of the soldiers, the question of accountability for private contractors remains unanswered. It is also unclear how systematic these abuses are. As you've just heard, the Department of Defense asked CBS to delay the airing of the story. The news that the Army had relieved soldiers on duty caused a stir last month, but in light of the shocking nature of the details of the investigation and the grave nature of the charges, the request for a postponement raises some questions. Jeffrey Fager is the executive producer of 60 Minutes 2. I asked him why CBS decided to delay breaking the story for 2 weeks.
Well, the Pentagon at the highest level asked us to hold it, and they asked us to hold it because there were Americans being held hostage. And they made a pitch at the very highest level, and directly from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Richard Marshall. liars that this could bring harm to a hostage if shown at that time. And, you know, that's a very tough issue for a journalist. We had a story that we felt was strong and still do, actually, but you're concerned that you don't want anybody to get hurt because of our story. We felt we could hold it because we knew it was not time-sensitive. There was military court action underway in Iraq, and we did.
How much of the story had the Pentagon seen, or had they just heard reports that you had this cold?
Oh, no, they hadn't seen anything. I mean, we just asked them for comment on the story that we had chased down. You know, it wasn't as if this was a story that hadn't been out there. I mean, they had a press conference to announce the court-martial action that was going to be taken and the fact that several soldiers had been relieved of duty. So it was a story that had been widely reported. It was just the idea that we had come upon the pictures. We called them to ask for an interview.
Where did the photographs come from?
Well, a source of ours.
Okay. Now, there's one thing that we're trying to get straight here. The people who were actually doing the interrogating, these were civilian contractors, and the U.S. soldiers were actually kind of softening up, to use that awful phrase, the prisoners in their charge?
That's what the Army investigation showed, that, in fact, there are civilian contractors who were doing the interrogating of detainees. And that's a big issue in and of itself. I think that is something that we have not been able to report out well, but I think is a story that has a great deal of merit and interest because they are above any military law. So if a civilian contractor, we couldn't even get an answer in terms of whether there are charges being brought against them. And our sense is that the answer is no.
Will you be following this up? Do you know what company they worked for example?
Yes, we will be following it up. There are several different companies that have civilian contractors over there. But I think it's a very important story. I think it's an important story, actually, where we have civilian contractors fighting in different parts of the world, including Colombia, where it's an important story, and I don't think people know that the extent to which contractors are being used. We weren't aware that contractors were being used as interrogators in prisons in Iraq.
Now, do they identify themselves as working for the CIA? In other words, we get into some deep interagency stuff where we think of these contractors as working for the Department of Defense. But now, is there any sense that say, the intelligence agencies are hiring their own separate, you know, military civilians to do work?
I just don't know.
Don't know.
I don't. I wish we could find out more, and we're going to try to.
How did you manage to get in? Because I went to Abu Ghraib and tried all of my charms and ploys to get past the guards at the gate just to take a look and say hello. And, boy, they weren't letting the press anywhere near this prison.
No, in fact, in this past winter in January, we sent Dan Rather down there with a crew, and he stayed on the perimeter. He couldn't get close either. But Steve Croft had gotten in October for a piece he was working on for 60 Minutes, and it is a very strong story. He did get in, and he got toured by the Brigadier General, who is now facing charges or some kind of disciplinary action, and she did show him the prison. He was skeptical at the time because he'd been directed in there by a family looking for a loved one at Abu Ghraib and was told that there were no charges brought against him, and the general, in fact, told Steve at the time, well, we bring charges within a day or two, and it had been 2 or 3 weeks. So he was incredibly skeptical, wasn't getting very good answers, and ironically, it was about that time, we believe now, while Steve was in the prison, that some of these things were taking place with Americans mistreating the Iraqi prisoners.
Jeffrey Fager, thank you very much.
Okay, Michael, thank you.
Jeffrey Fager is the executive producer of 60 Minutes 2. He spoke with me from New York. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amada, Jane Manners, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Darren Manoogian and Stanley Chang. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Michael Goldfarb, filling in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.